It's sold to us, and it's been sold to us a few times by now, as a health issue. But it always goes beyond that, especially in the minds of the people who'd be paying it.
The World Health Organization is urging global action to reduce the amount of sugary drinks being consumed around the world. The suggestion is that by implementing a 20% increase on the retail price of sugary beverages, it would result in a substantial decrease in the amount of sugar-filled drinks people consume.
There is currently a movement afoot among some liberal MPs to add a sugary soda tax to the party's platform for this fall's election. And we have some questions. Chief among them is this: even if we ignore all the arguments that come up as soon as a sugar tax is raised about personal responsibility, about freedom of choice, about small business owners, and about who this would actually hurt, would it even work? What would this tax be designed to achieve? And is there any research out there supporting this approach? Canada, after all, is not the first country to consider and even implement a tax on sugary sodas. So let's go into this with clear expectations and a barometer for success before we ask Canadians to pay more for a Coke. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Natalie Riediger is a researcher at the University of Manitoba who has been studying a sugary soda tax. How would it work? Would Canadians support it? What are the costs and benefits? Hi, Natalie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How often does this kind of thing come up? I mean, it seems like it's something we hear about somewhere else in the world fairly frequently.
Well, it's coming up more and more frequently. A number of countries have implemented a sugar-sweetened beverage tax over the last, I would say, 5 years. Especially. And then in 2016, the World Health Organization formally endorsed a sugar-sweetened beverage tax. And so that kind of put it back into the forefront of public health officials, and that resulted in more countries implementing such a tax.
So what does excessive sugar intake look like in Canada? What are we struggling with?
Well, sugar intake in Canada is a bit of a moving target because it's always changing and changing over time, as all food patterns do. Sugar intake in Canada has increased probably from about the 1980s up until the early 2000s, with sugar-sweetened beverages contributing the most to free sugar intake in Canada. However, since about 2004, intake of sugar-sweetened beverages like Pop or Kool-Aid or Tang, those types of drinks, have decreased over the last 10 years. But the most commonly consumed sugar-sweetened beverage in Canada is actually sugar-sweetened coffee.
Really?
And that's increased since 2004. So that also includes drinks like Frappuccinos or iced Frappuccinos,
yeah, of course.
Those types of drinks. So like anything, not just food, I mean, there's fads, right? And in the past, and I mean, people still drink Pop, but that tended to be, you know, one of the biggest contributors to sugar intake in Canada.
So what would a sugar tax actually do in Canada? What would it look like? And I guess just based on the research you're doing, what would that look like?
Well, we don't really know what it would look like. And that's part of what my research is about, because there are a lot of questions that are unanswered and kind of complexities around that. So one is, I already talked about the different types of drinks. So some of my research is looking at what have other countries done in terms of which drinks are included in sugar-sweetened beverage taxation, because there are so many drinks.
Right. Like, would you include Frappuccinos? I can't
yeah,
imagine
would
you
Well, that's an important question. And the countries that have implemented it, you know, there's quite a bit of variation in whether or not Frappuccinos are included and what type of Frappuccinos, because there are Frappuccinos that are bottled and sold in grocery stores. There are also Frappuccinos that are made on site, you know, where the sugar is added at the point of purchase. And then it becomes administratively difficult to decide, you know, what gets taxed and whether or not we add it after. And how does that contribute or like look according to what we're drinking over time? Because anytime we're talking about a public health policy, we're interested in population level effect. So who is it affecting? And if we don't include Frappuccinos or some Frappuccinos, is that the majority of the drinks people are drinking now? So that's one aspect of, what would it look like in Canada? What kinds of drinks? And if we don't include certain drinks, what does that mean for different groups? And then the other question that I have is related more so to the taxation aspect of it in terms of, different jurisdictions have different laws, like whether this is a provincial tax, a right. federal tax. What could or would that look like for First Nations reserves, which are of different jurisdictions? And how would that influence the purchasing environment related to sugary drinks? So that's another important question. And then the other question is about tax revenue. What would that look like?
Do we have any idea from places that have already implemented a tax like this, what kind of deterrent it has on the actual purchase and consumption of these drinks?
Yes, there's been quite a bit of research, I would say, well, a growing amount. And generally, so for example, Mexico, they've seen an overall decrease in sugar-sweetened beverage purchases. But there's also been an increase in purchasing of other non-taxed beverages. So it becomes really hard to assess what's really happening and what you're measuring. Is that what we should be measuring? So one of the other places that have introduced the tax is Philadelphia. But one of the issues with implementing it in like a municipality or a smaller geographic area is though they've seen sales of sugary drinks decrease in Philadelphia, they've increased right outside the city.
Right.
So what is the net gain or net benefit? We don't really know because it's so complicated. And then what is the other question is the revenue and, what else is happening to change intake? Like, so for example, in Mexico, as a country, that country had one of the highest intakes of sugary drinks. So there was probably only one way for it to go, which is down. And in Canada, our intake has also gone down, but we didn't have a tax.
Is that just a result of kind of more awareness, more health marketing?
I think so. I mean, in the research I've done so far, most people have heard that sugar is not great for their health. It's not a surprise to most people. They're quite aware. So I think that has contributed quite a bit probably to the decrease in consumption among certain groups, particularly the more higher educated people
right.
have reduced their consumption.
In the response, either from people who kind of participate or just from people you end up discussing this with, are people generally for or against a sugar tax? Because I'm fascinated by the reaction.
Oh, I think I've heard everything. Would I say most people are supportive or unsupportive? I'd say it's pretty divided for a lot of different reasons. And if people are just talking to me, I'm pretty neutral about my own feelings. And so I think people are being honest. But yeah, there's a mix. There's support, there's anger, and everything in between.
How similar would this be to the taxing we do of tobacco? And do we have research that puts sugar kind of in those categories or even a system like that already in place that we could use?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people who support the sugar-sweetened beverage tax have compared it to tobacco because there's a lot of the same kind of dynamics with industry and then, the tactics, right? The tactic is the same, taxing. I think there are a lot of lessons we have learned from tobacco, which we should think about. And I mean, there are a lot of other policies that have targeted tobacco that are not taxation that have contributed to changes in smoking rates, but then also how we view tobacco. So yeah, I think there's a lot to learn, not just the success. So, and the success is usually attributed to the decrease in smoking we've seen over the last number of decades. But we also still see quite a number of people who smoke. And yeah, so I think there's a lot to learn.
Given that you've seen sort of the huge spectrum of responses, both in support or against something like this, and given our current political climate in which every party tends to be either for something or totally against it, do you think there's any traction here politically for this kind of tax?
I think right now there's probably not a lot of traction. Discussion kind of heated up about this sugar sweetened beverage tax when the Liberals first came into government and they were developing their healthy eating strategy.
Right.
And it was considered. And then the government ended up deciding to go with different policies. So, for example, we've got the new Canada's Food Guide. They upped investments to Nutrition North Canada. And then there's also going to be a food marketing ban targeting children. So there won't be any marketing of unhealthy foods towards children. And that's going to be coming out in the next 2 years or so. I think a lot of, you know, the discussion in the future will depend on how the next election goes. Because, yeah, I think depending on which party gets in power, that could shape whether or not this gets on the agenda. And then the other thing is probably the carbon tax. You know, just put in this carbon tax. So does another part, does the party want to put in another one?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Here's a question. And without getting into, because I know the, you know, freedom of choice, libertarian angle of this is really an issue because people want to be able to choose what they buy and consume. Putting that aside, would implementing a tax like this hurt anyone? Would there be anybody who would lobby against it from a business or health point of view?
Well, there's already been lobbyists lobbying against it. Obviously, the big ones, the Beverage Association, and also small businesses. And I'm particularly interested in how this might affect low-income groups. People who are food insecure or who struggle to afford food tend to be higher consumers of sugary drinks. So I think when we're considering raising the price of a drink disproportionately consumed by people who can't afford food, that's an important ethical question. This is what we've started to see now with tobacco is, you know, you're hurting or punishing people for, you know, engaging in these behaviors, but there's not a lot of support for alternatives or for, in the case of smoking, you know, smoking cessation programs or, you know, in the case of food, we haven't really done much to reduce food insecurity.
Do you feel like we'll have a handle on the costs and benefits of this over the next couple of years? Because like I mentioned at the beginning, you know, this is an issue that sort of seems to pop up every year or two. And it would be lovely if we could figure out whether or not this is a way forward for us, or we just have to stop proposing it.
Well, me personally, I think we need to kind of go back to what is the problem. And because this is a public health policy and my expertise is public health, I'm not convinced yet of what the problem is. Like to me, and I'm interested in health equity, I don't see this policy necessarily promoting health equity or fairness. I mean, we see the highest rates of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease among low socioeconomic groups, lower income, lower education. And what we've seen with tobacco is that those are the same groups that continue to have the highest prevalence of smoking. So I don't see how that could reduce inequalities. I think we need to get a handle on, what is the problem? I mean, are we going to reduce obesity? Nowhere that's implemented this policy have we seen a reduction in obesity.
Which is theoretically the main aim of this policy, no?
Yes, that would be the goal. We've villainized food for a long time. That's been our MO in nutrition. You know, don't eat eggs, don't eat saturated fat or any fat. And now, you know, we've just kind of villainized the next food. Has it made us healthier? I mean, people usually take up that knowledge and change what they eat. I don't see it necessarily changing a whole lot on the health front of populations. And I think I'm very interested in socially how the tax might impact people because it's positioned as an obesity reduction strategy. And we have a lot of weight stigma in Canada and in high income countries where, you know, we shame and blame people for their weight. Mm-hmm. And this kind of just continues that same narrative. And I don't know that at the population level, that's all that helpful because there's been more and more research showing people can't lose weight. It's just almost impossible. So these are some tough questions we need to wrestle with, whether we need to keep making people feel bad for the food that they eat.
Natalie Riediger, researcher at the University of Manitoba. And that was The Big Story. We've got more for you at thebigstorypodcast.ca. And you can talk to us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Looking for more podcasts? We've got a bunch, including Roz and Mocha, Moms in the Middle, and more at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. And you can find every last one of our podcasts wherever you get them. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, you pick, we're there. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.